Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 30th of April. The wage ratio between women and men failed to narrow in 2006, and an earlier trend toward equal pay has stalled. This according to a study from the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Their study titled The Wage Gap Persisting in 2006. And our guest is Heidi Hartman, who is president of the Institute. It's a scientific research organization that she founded in 1987 to meet the need for women-centered, policy-oriented research. She's also a research professor at the George Washington University, and she is vice chair of the National Council on Women's Organizations and co-editor of the Journal of Women, Politics, and Policy. Another study released also from AAUW shows a persistent inequality when it comes to salary earnings among college-educated men and women. Why is it that this trend toward equal pay has stalled? What are the figures exactly when it comes to how much men are making, how much women are making for the same kind of job? What legislation is on the books here concerning all of this, and what turns it around? And what are your experiences in the labor market? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you be joining us in Milwaukee today, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Heidi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
So give us the summary of the report. Where are we? How are we stalled?
Well, I'd say we've stalled since about the mid-90s. The progress in closing the wage gap has simply slowed down. I don't think any of us who study these issues have a really good explanation for it. But it's pretty clear in the data that there has been a slowdown. There's a couple of different types of data, but they all, you know, tend to show the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And we're looking at, just in terms of understanding the data, what is the data? Is it looking at part-time workers or full-time workers or what?
Well, the most typical comparison is looking at women and men who work full-time year-round and comparing their annual earnings. And that number was 77.0 in 2005, meaning that women earned 77% of what men earned for full-time year-round work.
Mm-hmm.
And that number had been similar in 2002, and you can see a noted slowdown in closing the gap starting in the mid to late 90s. Then there's another series that looks at weekly earnings. You don't have to have worked all year, but you do work. They do compare just full-time workers in a given week, and they average that over the year. And that stalled out at an 80.8%, meaning that a typical woman in an average week of working full-time earns 80.8% of what a typical man earns. And that also hadn't changed much at all since 2003. And again, that slowed down since the early 90s in that data series.
Mm-hmm. We've known about this for such a long period of time. We've addressed this. Every year we get studies like this. People hear that figure, and most of them, I think, are very upset by it, Heidi. But it's interesting to me that it doesn't change. Why?
Well, that's the mystery. I mean, we have laws on the books. We have Title VII. Of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which was even strengthened in 1991. We have a number of lawsuits every year that are won by women. Of course, there's the big one, the Walmart class action. It's still
right.
In the works, and we'll see how that turns out. But there has been progress in closing the gap. The fact that the gap is closing more slowly doesn't mean there's no progress. So it is still closing. It's just closing more slowly, and in the last 2 years we haven't seen any change, but most years you do see some small change. It's not too dissimilar from getting women elected into office. We moved from 15% of women in Congress to 16%.
Mm-hmm.
We'd all like that to be 51-53%, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just like we'd like the wage ratio to be 100%,
right,
meaning zero gap. So I think the thing that interests me about the wage gap is that I feel that women are doing virtually everything they can do. They have been getting the education, considering that they have careers, not just pin money jobs. They take it seriously. They're going to college. They're going to college at higher rates than men. And yet they're not getting the equal rewards. The AAUW study that was released last week did compare, specifically took a look at college graduates, compared even those with the same major, and in the same year out of college, even those with the same major, the women are earning less.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that the women are doing what they can do, and I think the rest is up to employers and governments to enforce the laws more thoroughly.
Yeah. What about when you said women are doing what they can do? Some have said, and maybe I say this from personal experience as well, that women are not, for whatever reason, and we can examine why, that they're not very tough when it comes to negotiating their salaries in terms of employment, that we tend to be kind of meek in this area.
Well, there's one explanation. I mean, another is different majors, but even accounting for that, that doesn't make it all go away. Another is, of course, that women do more of the family care than men.
Right.
And they are spending time out of the labor market, and men or women who spend time out of the labor market do tend to go back with not the wage growth that they would have had they not done that. So the fact that women do that more than men, ultimately that can affect their future earnings. But what was so interesting about the AUW study was that this is, you know, the first year out of college before that should even come into play, and they still found lesser pay for women. I don't think, and negotiation is certainly a possibility, but I think that that's a tricky one because men and women who negotiate with the same style may be received very differently.
Hmm.
So a woman who, there was just an example, I think it was from the Washington Post, where it says a man will say, I got this offer, I'm going to leave if you don't match it. If a woman says that, she's going to be perceived as very threatening and they're not going to want to be inclined to match it. A woman should go in and say, I'd really like to stay here, but I do have this competing offer, and I'm hoping you can help me out by mm-hmm. matching it. So, you know, it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you're too aggressive, you're going to be a pariah, and yet you have to find a way to try to represent your interests on the job. Obviously, labor unions are a huge help. If you look at the occupations where labor unions are active or professional associations like in teaching, you find a much smaller pay gap. I think it was about 95% for first-year teachers, women still earning a little less than men. That could be partly because they may teach more in the lower grades,
mm-hmm.
and it's possible that teachers in the higher grades get higher pay on average.
I'm just trying to imagine as you're talking here about who the people are who think that they can pay women less. I mean, are there people who are really bad actors in this whole drama, or is it just so much a part of the way business has been done that all employers do this? Because we know better by now, Heidi.
Well, some people say, some of the psychologists and others have been developing this concept of a framework or a mindset, and you have a mindset, women and men have it, as to what the types of job duties are suitable for women, what types of ways they can bargain are suitable for them, what types of salaries they have. Just the whole idea that women don't want to travel, that's a mindset, an assumption. And if employers use that in deciding, let's say for NPR, who's going to come to Washington to do a special training and tend to think more about the men than the women,
mm-hmm.
That will be an opportunity that a woman will lose out on. So people have these mindsets. They don't think of them as discriminatory. They just think of them as the way the world is.
Mm-hmm.
And but those very common habits of mind can be things that do tend to disadvantage women. And it doesn't have to be, as you suggest, it doesn't have to be a mean employer sitting at his desk saying, I want to pay my women less.
Right,
see
right.
How much I can get away with. It can just be an accumulation of small things. Well, I'll assign more of this overtime to Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Mary has kids. Well, Joe has kids too, but everybody knows he needs the money, so
mm-hmm.
the overtime goes to Joe. Well, maybe Mary needs the money, but nobody's asked her.
Mm-hmm.
How about this trip? I'll assign that to Mike. Patty doesn't like to travel,
mm-hmm.
You know, and it just one thing after another, mm-hmm. and it can accumulate into less good assignments where you would be noticed by upper management and where that might lead to a future promotion. That's a typical one that, people in industry talk about, the assignment of a special task force where you'll get noticed by people in other departments and higher-ups. That if those go more to men than women, that's one reason why men get more of the promotions.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Heidi. Heidi Hartman is our guest, president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, which is an organization that she founded back in 1987, I believe. She is talking about the wage gap, the study released last week on the wage gap, which persists in 2006. She says that it failed to narrow in 2006, and an earlier trend toward equal pay has stalled. So we're analyzing statistics from the Department, from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and welcoming phone calls from you. And you're the people who can really shed light on what's going on inside the workplace. I'm sure that some of you have been aware of pay disparities here. You have comments perhaps on why it is that we've known about this for a long period of time, and we know how important male and female contributions are in the workplace. Are women being penalized because there is a perception that they don't like to travel, because they do more of the family work? Do women want to do more of that as well? So that may penalize them in a well. Do they relish that role? Do men need to step up to the plate more in the family realm? I would think we'll get a lot of calls on this, so give us a ring. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee today, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. Heidi is also research professor at the George Washington University. She's vice chair of the National Council of Women's Organizations and also co-editor of the Journal of Women, Politics, and Policy. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll start taking your calls in just a moment. Our spring pledge drive is going to be starting this week on May 3rd. And if you would like to pledge online before that official on-air pledge drive starts, that would be great, because then maybe if you helped us reach a goal of $275,000, we wouldn't even have to start the drive. Members have contributed over $11,000 toward our goal of $275,000. If we do reach that before the 3rd of May, then we wouldn't start the drive. You can pledge online and move us along toward that goal at WPR.org. Professor Heidi Hartman is our guest, president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. We're talking about the wage gap, which persists in 2006, and we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. Rita from Dubuque is our first caller. Hi, Rita.
Hi. I'm wondering what her attitude is about. Is the pay gap a moral issue? My sister taught 11 years, and she was a nun, so she got paid nothing. And now she's 74, and she's just poverty. She's not getting it. So she didn't get paid, so she doesn't get Social Security. And isn't that immoral to leave this nun? She came out of the nuns after 11 years, and she is getting no Social Security for the 11 years that she was a teacher. Is it moral?
Well, in general, I think poverty and inequality and low pay is immoral. I mean, I think that we all should be in favor of a job paying what it's worth and people being able to live on the money that they earn. So I would hope that her order would be compensating her in some way in retirement.
Yeah, you would think the order is not doing this, or did she leave the order?
She left the order in 68. She left the she after teaching 11 years. She left the order in 68.
Uh-huh.
So she is just getting the minimum $400 a month. She's living on $400 a month because she was not paid for a teacher. She wasn't paid anything for those 11 years. So no, they are not. The Franciscan nuns in Dubuque are not paying her.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have any system for taking care of people who were nuns for a number of years but didn't actually retire as nuns.
Mm-hmm.
It's against the law that they don't pay their teachers. I think it's
What has she done since 1968?
Oh, well, she was she came out and she got married and she has a son. She raised a son after she came out of the nunneries. So
she must have worked at least 10 years at something.
Oh, she came out and she worked in a grocery store. for minimum wage. She came out and she couldn't get a job after she came out because she had tenure. And tenure in Iowa, they tend to hire the kids right out of the college, out of this college, rather than pay tenure. Mm-hmm. In Iowa. That's Iowa, though. So mm-hmm. I appreciate your listening.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. Did you pay any special attention? I know your institute does. Did you pay some attention here? Can look at the numbers of low-wage women workers.
Well, sure. Women are disproportionately low-wage. They're about 60% of the minimum wage workers.
Are they really?
And if we took a look at women and men who earned low wages year after year, and we found that of the people who do that year after year, 90% are women. So it seems that low wage is more of a temporary thing for a man, but could be more of a long-run phenomenon for a woman.
Mm-hmm. And then I keep thinking, Heidi, about all of the financial pressures on women who are not making very much money, particularly women with children, you know, this daycare business. We haven't seen any major studies. Maybe you've done one and I didn't see it, but we haven't seen any major studies on this in some time now. I would just think that they are so strapped financially.
Well, I think the good news, in a way, for the child care workers is that child care costs have been going up. But unfortunately, child care workers are an example of a woman, predominantly woman profession, where a fair amount of skill is required, but those skills aren't rewarded with good pay. Child care workers are still among the lowest paid, even though the costs have been going up overall. And it is a dilemma if you're a low-paid woman worker in another industry and trying to pay for child care. It is extremely difficult. One of the things we didn't talk about in the beginning when we talked about who needs to do what, I said that women had done most of what they need to do, but that governments and employers hadn't. And I think the big area where we as a society have not done enough is in subsidizing the cost of child care.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just that individual mother's responsibility to raise that child. She is really doing that for all of us. We all need future workers. Mm-hmm. We all need future payers of our Social Security, future soldiers, future police people, firefighters, future secretaries.
Sure.
We all need those things. And in most societies, those costs are shared more widely through public support for child care, through public support for child allowances, an actual cash grant that goes to each family with a child. This is common in many countries around the world. We don't have it. This would go, this type of cash grant would go to a rich person or a middle class person or a poor person
mm-hmm.
if they had a child. So there's so many ways in which, you know, other than public school, which we all support, there are so many ways in which we're not sharing costs.
Thanks for your call. We go next to Sandy from Algoma. Hello, Sandy.
Hi. I've given this a lot of thought over the course of the years, and I think that the disparity between men and women's wages is mostly due to the fact that we have had a male-dominated society forever. I mean, since the beginning of time, they're the ones who made all the rules, and basically they're still making all the rules because most of the businesses, I think, are owned by men. And, I mean, I work in the nursing field. I'm a nurse, and we have some male nurses, and I know just from talking to them that they make more money than the female nurses, and that's pretty sad. The women, they don't push it. You know, they should be. They need to, and we all need to start doing that.
Well, I think one thing I've heard in nursing is that the men will more rapidly move up into supervisory positions. And I do think there's a certain amount of, you know, because the guy's difference, he stands out and he's noticed more, and that may work to his advantage in a field like nursing. But when I was talking before about that frame of mind, which, you know, every man and woman has a mindset about what women and men should do, that essentially comes from that age-old culture that you are talking about, that in that culture, men have always been in the leadership positions, have been in power. They're still 85% of our U.S. Congress, for example. And sure, it cascades all throughout society. Every social institution that we have reflects that. And it's been, quite some time, I guess we could say, for as long as we've known, there have always been women who have protested this situation and challenged it, and we haven't succeeded in totally overcoming it yet. Although, I would say we've made good progress. We just haven't completely overthrown it.
Right. You know, that figure does knock you out. You've said it, when you said it that way, it just knocked me out. 85% of Congress is male. Isn't that something?
Yeah. And something like, 89% of the Supreme Court.
Right. Yeah.
1 out of 9 is a woman. Supreme Court.
Sandy, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Brian from Michigan. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Okay. I guess my observation, maybe more of a small business setting than in the big corporation, it kind of comes from this idea that still is lingering, that men are kind of head of the household. And what I see is, kind of like if a woman has a job somewhere, it's assumed that, the husband has an equal or better job, but the man is not always, he's more assumed to be the sole breadwinner. And I think more in a small setting, employers might take this into consideration. And I know there's still disparity just because of prejudice or whatever you want to call it, but I still think there's that perception of this head of the household and that, there's not this other income necessarily as well. So I'll take my comment out there.
All right, Brian, thanks.
I think Brian's very right about that. It's been shown, for example, that marriage and having children will tend statistically to raise a man's salary, controlling for all other factors, whereas they statistically reduce a woman's salary, controlling for all other factors, so that the man is almost rewarded for the fact that he's should be the breadwinner of the family, and the woman is penalized for the fact that she should be the caregiver of the family. But as a practical matter, it's about 15 to 20% of women now who do out-earn their husbands.
Hmm.
For example, nursing has a fairly high hourly pay for a typically woman's job. It is a highly skilled job. They do tend to have strong union representation. And while I certainly think nurses deserve even more pay, it's relatively high among all women's jobs. And there are many nurses who out-earn their husbands on an hourly basis.
Hmm. Thanks so much for the call. We go next to Jan from Menominee Falls. Hi, Jan.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate this program today, and I just wanted to share an experience that I had working part-time for a company, and I worked with males, too, and I was taking more classes and training myself and getting better experience than my male cohorts, but I wasn't getting the raises, and my hours were being cut. Mm. And I talked to my boss about it, and he said, well, they have mortgages and car payments to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, my husband was not employed. I was the only income in our family. And the other part of this is that my boss was a very religious person. He would have Bible classes before work for certain employees. And I believe, and I know this for a fact, too, that in their religion, that women are subservient to men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the religious, certain religious societies may use this as an excuse.
I think there is still that view. But what kind of recourse does somebody like Jan have? Because you can't get away with that. I mean, legally, you can't get away with that, with saying that the guys have got mortgages and car payments. You can't do that, can you, Heidi?
No, that would be certainly evidence of discrimination.
Yeah.
But you'd have to file a complaint. Only businesses with 15 or more workers are covered by the federal Title VII, the Civil Rights Act. I don't know about the laws in Wisconsin if they cover smaller businesses or not.
Mm-hmm. And then word gets out, too, and you're kind of blacklisted from, that certain sect that you might want to...
Yeah, certainly. If you work in a small town, it might go all over town. If you are in a particular occupation or profession, it might filter through that. And it takes your own money and time, and it can be very grueling.
Right.
So many, many people do not file complaints. But other than getting together with a group of similarly situated people at your workplace, Evelyn Murphy, former lieutenant governor of Massachusetts has started a project called the Wage Project, and she's organizing wage clubs all around the country to encourage women to confront their bosses in a group to say, you know, we have some sense that we're underpaid here, and what are you going to do about it?
Well, I hope the word gets out on that, because I think that could be very powerful, too. And
was there more than one person in your situation, or were you pretty much alone?
I was pretty much alone.
And that's a former job. You're not still there?
I am not, no.
That's what most people do. They move on.
Right.
They move on and put it behind them. And I think, you know, I think in many ways that's a good approach. If you can get better pay and a better job to move to, that's not a bad approach. But if, especially if the situation seems to you to be, you know, difficult, you don't have a lot of people in your same situation, so it's going to be hard to prove a case, and, and you don't really like the way you're being treated anyway. So, you know, I think that's what most people do. They move on and look for something better.
Yeah.
But my point, too, was that there, about the, if there have been any studies or anything about the real...
About religious motivation? I haven't seen any studies of that. The one thing I do know of studies by, I believe it's Jennifer Glass at the University of Iowa, who has looked at whether being a member of a traditional religious group affects women's behavior in terms of how much they work outside the home, how often they divorce, how much they use child care. And I believe her general finding was it doesn't make much difference. In other words, there's an economic reality that's affecting families today, and it's something that your ideology, you know, can't have that much influence on. If you're, if you need the money, you'll work. If you need child care, you'll get child care. But I could see that it could definitely influence the behavior of managers. We've heard a lot about it in the Army and the military about people discriminating against everyone who isn't Protestant, even against chaplains that aren't Protestant. This is a recent case I saw mentioned in the paper. So I think that where there is a kind of religious homogeneity, I think it certainly can create an in-group and an out-group. And I think, you know, the people that are not perceived as being in the in-group probably can be discriminated against at work. But I've not seen anything overall on specific religions leading more to this than other religions.
Thanks, Jan, very much for the call. Let's talk about men for a moment. How much of the wage gap do you think would disappear if men were equal participants in children's sickness, taking children to the doctor, children are off school because they're sick, mom stays home usually, can't take a trip right now because I've got a very young child at home and no daycare. The daycare falls through. All of those things that that usually women do. What if men started doing that, too?
Wouldn't that be great?
Well, it would change things significantly,
yeah.
I think, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I do think it would. I don't have an estimate, though, of how it would specifically affect the wage gap, but I certainly think that that more equal parenting is something we need almost a public education campaign about. I've been thinking about calling it the double standard of parenting, and for those of us who might be old enough to remember, there once was a double standard for sexual behavior in which it was pretty much taken for granted that married men would have affairs, but married women would not. Men would have sex before marriage, but women would not. And this is pretty much eroded. It's pretty much a not so much a sexual double standard. You know, it's more similar, I'd say, now for young men and young women and married men and married women, and I don't think we think of it as something that only men do. So whether you think of that as liberation or whatever, it certainly was a huge cultural shift, a huge cultural change, and I think we need a similarly huge cultural change around standards of parenting. I think there's just a sense that the mother is the caretaker, and she parents more intensively than the male.
Let's go next to Liz from Fish Creek. Hi, Liz.
Hi there. I have a book to recommend. I recently saw Rian Eisler at the Green Festival, and she just released a new title, and it's called The Real Wealth of Nations. And she's the author of The Chalice of the Glade. and she's the author of Sacred Pleasure. And these two previous titles have tackled the relationship between the genders. The first one really went after religion, the second one after sex, and now it's money. I mean, she's a bold woman. And what her argument is that our entire economic system is based upon artificial yardsticks. It just failed to factor in the real economy and real economics. And she has some proposals in there for how we re-correct this. And she discusses, you know, the history and the future of this issue. And she does a darn good job. And if you know the book, I'd love to hear you talk about it.
Well, funny you should mention it. I've just been cleaning up my office, and I came across a table of contents in the first chapter, which she had sent me.
Oh.
And I did see that it was very, very engagingly written, and she does talk a lot about specifically the issue we were just talking about, the need to share care more broadly throughout the society and between men and women. That caregiving is a very important part of the economy that we're overlooking. The Nation magazine, for example, a month or so ago had a special issue, or one of its regular issues, but a special section on the title story was called The Economics of Care. And care studies is sort of becoming a new academic rubric under which people are really beginning to think seriously about how to value care more in our economy.
Mm-hmm.
I know that in her book, Rian calls this the caring revolution. You know, I like that. It sounds real good.
Thanks so much for the call, Liz. Let's welcome more phone calls. We have some lines open if you want to join us. We'd love to hear from you. We're talking about the wage gap, the study on the wage gap done by the Institute for Women's Policy Research, in which they find it persists in 2006. Heidi Hartman, president and founder of the Institute, is our guest. 800-486-8655 is our number. Steve from Johnson Center is next. Heidi. Hi, Steve.
Well, hello there. Good morning. I might be a bit nervous, but the question I have is has anybody ever done a study at the cost of having a female employee over a male employee? For instance, it costs more to insure females, especially in childbearing years. And also, if a female employee has children, she's more apt to take more personal time off.
Well, there are quite a few studies of that. It would appear that women compensate for having children by taking less time off for other reasons. So in general, when you compare the level of the job, if you compare the same level job, women, in fact, are not more likely to be absent from work than men. We might think of them as absent more possibly because they may tend to have lower level jobs, and absenteeism is a little greater in those lower level jobs. But that would be true of men and women, both holding that level of job. They do have to take off more time for family care because it isn't as equally shared by men, but they apparently compensate by taking less off other times. Other costs of employment, men are just as likely to have children on their health insurance policies as women are. It's true they don't go through childbirth, so that is one effect they don't have. But men do have more acute illness, which does lead to a sharp incidence of illness, a hospitalization, and so on. Men have more of that. Women have more chronic illness, most of which they can probably often work through. Other examples of costs that we know about, men are more likely to steal from work. They're more likely to get into altercations at work and lose time for that reason. They apparently are more likely to come to work under the effects of drugs or alcohol. So there's some suggestion that actually men are more costly to employ than women, although I don't think it's definitive. I think, you know, we probably might be about the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're reaching a point where everybody's pretty costly when it comes to medical insurance, and that's another issue, right?
Yeah. Older people are more costly, and you saw Walmart sending memos, internal memos, saying make everybody stand, don't let them sit.
Yeah.
In a way to discourage older people who might have health problems from taking jobs there. And so employers are definitely up against it with health
mm-hmm.
costs, and they're trying all kinds of strategies, not all of which I think we would think would be socially valuable.
We have a couple lines open. Join us if you'd like. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in the Milwaukee area. One of the recommendations that came from the other study that you mentioned, the AAUW study, which looked at college-educated women and how they're faring, and it's not very well, they had a specific recommendation that sex-segregated occupations, science, technology, engineering, math, should be more aggressively marketed to young women. What do you think of that?
I think that's a great idea. I think that those occupations are higher-end, higher-paying occupations, and it would be great to get more women into them. I think girls do take almost as much math as boys. They may take even more in some situations, but they're not always steered into those jobs that background would qualify for them or encouraged to pursue. Mm-hmm. Say, an engineering major at college. So we've seen some, again, over the years, we've seen some increases in women in engineering, women in computer science, but maybe just not as fast as we would like.
Well, thanks, Steve, very much for your call. We go to Lee next from Shawano. Hi, Lee.
Yes, hi, Kathleen and Dr. Hartman. My main concern is, yes, I agree wholeheartedly. Years ago, the standards were exactly like you had put it. Men were responsible for the family, and they were kind of the main sole providers, and women always stayed at home, took care of the kids, the house, and whatever. But nowadays, it's just a rabid big world out there. You've got many divorced women, many unmarried women that are raising children, and I really feel we're so tremendously behind times. We should be up to date. More. You know what I'm saying with the current times right now, and women should be making as much as men, or maybe just a little tiny less, but they have to pay their rent just as a man would have to if he lived alone and he had kids taken. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Okay.
I thought you were going to say that women should be paid slightly more because they're more likely to have children than men.
Well, that's very true, too.
But you're absolutely right. If looked at from a child's point of view, a child is just as likely to be working, living with a working mom as a working dad, because the most typical family form is still the one in which there are two parents raising children, but it's one in which both parents are working.
Sure it is,
so
yeah.
All those moms are working. Then the next most common family form is the mother alone raising children without a man present. Now, there may be a man, contributing some child support, but there also might not be. And then the next common, getting more toward the bottom, is the traditional, what we used to call the traditional family, where the man works and the woman does not. And then finally, the least common form of families with children would be single dads. Hmm. Those are growing, but they are much smaller. So there's just as many mothers in the workforce who live with their children as there are fathers in the workforce who live with their children. So from the kids' point of view, any kid you look at is just as likely to have a working mom as a working dad.
Right, yeah. What a change that is, Heidi, isn't it?
It's a huge change.
It is a huge change and a recent change.
Absolutely. This growth in the labor force participation of mothers in particular was in the 70s and the 80s, a very rapid increase.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lee, so much for your call. Donna from Menominee is next. Hi, Donna.
Hi.
Hi.
Over the last 30 years, I've known a number of couples who would have preferred, when they had small children, that each of them work perhaps half-time. The reason they couldn't do this was because in order to have health care coverage for their family, somebody had to work full-time. And it seems to me that if we could get universal health coverage and unhook it from employment, it would make an enormous difference in the amount of flexibility that men and women have in how they approach their jobs, and it would ultimately impact the employers and the culture's perception of whether or not men are involved actively in parenting.
Hmm.
I think that would be wonderful. I couldn't agree with you more. If we could get something like Medicare for All, which is, not hooked to employment, it's a public health single-payer program, that would, I think you're absolutely right. Now, interestingly, there are certain men's occupations where the family relies on the woman for health care, occupations like construction or farming, ranching. The woman will often get a clerical office job, which will have health care for the family attached to it. So there's we took a look during the early Clinton administration when health care reform was very much in the air, and there's an enormous amount of exactly what you're saying, one adult in the family carrying the health insurance for everyone. And while that is more often the man than the woman, it is sometimes the woman.
Right.
And that is just an amazing thing that locks, you know, people into particular jobs and into particular work schedules.
Mm-hmm.
There might be, you know, there might be many employers that are large enough to sort of say, offer a 20-hour job, a 25-hour job, a 30-hour job, 35-hour job, a 40-hour job, you know, offer a variety of job lengths depending on what their workers want. But among the main reasons they don't do it is that it complicates the benefit picture so much.
Hmm. Anything else? Anything else, Donna?
Well, I just wanted to say that the couples I know, you know, often face the reality that two full-time jobs, or even one full-time job and a half-time job, when children are very small, really puts an enormous stress on the family.
Yes, it does.
And so what happens is not just that they end up living on one income, and, of course, that only requires the loss of one job to throw everything into chaos.
Mm-hmm.
But women then are effectively out of the job market. And though when they reenter the job market, perhaps 4 or 5 years later, perhaps less, then no recent experience absolutely slaps them in the face, particularly if you do office work, as many women do. I face this myself. It's like, oh, well, you couldn't possibly be competent at this because you don't have command of the latest programs. And here you are, you know, with your somewhat older body and your no longer great legs, competing with young women just out, you know, of school who have up-to-the-minute computer skills. Now, I personally have never found it a problem to get up to speed once I have the job. But nobody wants to hear that. So I think there's an odd thing that happens to women's careers, which is justified by saying, well, you were on the mommy track or you were out or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty appalling.
Well, I think that many women share that experience, that they come back to the labor market, but they aren't received with open arms and they're considered out of date. There's a little bit of a mixed statistical review of that. I mean, we've done some research that suggested that women, especially who were out for childbirth, actually did recover their wage loss quite quickly. As you said, you know, hey, I'm smart, I can learn it on the job. And so some women are able to do that. Other data suggests that anyone, a man or a woman, who takes time out of the labor force will receive about a 20% pay cut for, say, 1 year out of the labor force.
Hmm.
So the statistical evidence is a little bit mixed on that, but I think that the situation that we have now, as the caller says, it's dysfunctional. It's forcing the families to do something they don't really want to do. They prefer to share child care. They prefer to reduce their work hours. And in a country where you were given a cash award, a child allowance for having a child, both parents could reduce work hours and get compensation, you know, for having had the kid,
right.
And that would help them have reduced work hours while their children are young. I mean, Canada has that. Most of the countries in Europe have it. So, you know, there's just so much we could be doing to make it easier for parents to have more flexibility and more choices.
Thank you very much for your call, Donna. Let's go next to Jeremy from Wittenberg. Hi, Jeremy. Hi, Jeremy. It's a bad phone, so if you can speak clearly, please.
Yes, I will. I just wanted to make a point that even though women do get the low end of the deal usually, there's a lot of men out there, myself included, who would like to take care of the child 50%.
Uh-huh.
Relationship, the way society runs, they give them more towards the female.
Okay. Did you get that, Heidi? Could you hear it?
He did say that there are a lot of men out there who would like to do 50% of the child care, but they're not encouraged to do
right,
so.
Right.
I didn't know whether he meant by society at large or the particular woman involved. And
let's just take society at large.
I think definitely society at large very much can look askance at the house husband or the man who goes down to part-time for 6 months while his child is young. That there's almost an indicator that there's something wrong with him. He's not as ambitious as he should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, very unfortunate. It would have been great if Tony Blair had taken his parental leave that he was entitled to in England when his wife had his last baby and, you know, turn over the government to somebody else for 6 weeks or 6 months. His wife was really after him to do it, but he wouldn't do it. And that would be, that's the kind of, you know, big, high-profile example we need. We need a lot of that. We need more of that to show that, hey, this is a great choice. Successful men do it. It's a great choice.
You only have one chance to do it, too. You know, it goes so fast, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah, it goes fast. Jeremy, thanks for the call. Sarah is next. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. I'm going to play the devil's advocate here and speak up for a group of people that seem to get the brunt of people's childbearing choices. And I think that is the point, that having children is a choice. And, it, you know, there's a group. I'm a child-free adult. I've been married for 22 years. And, unfortunately, nobody sees the people that are working the holidays and working the off shifts to make up for the fact that people chose to have children and now have sort of an entitlement mindset that, you know, because of a choice, it's not a right, it's a responsibility. And if they're not prepared for that responsibility, I don't think they should be having kids, you know, and expecting other people to make up for it. And I guess that's just my point.
That's pretty harsh, Sarah. Kids are good. We need people to replenish when we all die.
There's enough people on the planet, I think, now. we could slow down a little, I think. And there's a very growing population of child-free adults, and unfortunately, they're the ones that take the brunt.
How so? In terms of what?
I'm perfectly willing to pay for schools, even though I don't get a direct payback from
We all do.
Yeah, I'm saying a direct payback. The indirect payback is to have a educated.
Right.
Society that is willing to take care of itself and take responsibility for its choices. And childbearing is a choice. It's not an inevitability. And people, I think a lot of people, you know, just have children because that's what society expects them to do and not because they really want to. Or they can, you know, and it's not a matter of affording them. I think everybody, if someone really wants children, they should be able to have them. There should be things there to support that choice, but I think it's gone too far. There's an entitlement mindset with people who have children. They just expect that because I have children, I have special rights and should be able to, well, basically take off anytime they want from work. And I think a lot of people would agree with me. And
all right.
Don't say anything because there's it's an unpopular opinion.
Yeah, well, I think you're being really harsh on parents. I don't think they take off of work anytime they feel like it. And I know there are parents who are poor who are leaving kids who are at home sick because they got to bring money home. I don't know. I just think you're being pretty harsh on parents. But what do you think, Heidi? Are people who choose to not have children having to bear the brunt here?
Well, I don't know that they're having to bear the brunt. I think they certainly have every right not to have children, and I think
the
caller makes a good point that, you know, especially in the old days, people routinely had children who didn't necessarily want them because it was expected. I think now people do think of it more as something they should choose and prepare for and be excited about, although we still have a lot of unintended pregnancy because we don't have very good sex education and don't have the best access to contraception and abortion that we might want. I think that, you know, the caller maybe misses the point that societies do need to reproduce, and when she says there are plenty of children in the world, that may be true, but they're not distributed all that well. So if American women, for example, stopped having children, then we would have to meet our needs for future population through greater immigration. And we already have a fairly high level of immigration. So I think most societies want to have a mix between, you know, reproducing themselves and inviting new people in. And I think the U.S., you know, probably has a pretty decent mix that way, so that we probably still need to have some children of U.S. natives born. So I don't think that we can, just say, oh, we've got enough children in the world, so, you know, we don't need to encourage any more children to be born of U.S. natives. That doesn't seem to me that would be really socially something that would work that well, because you would then have to be absorbing a great many people from abroad. And, you know, we're already having trouble with the number we're absorbing now. So I think that solution, you know, as ideal as it sounds, it doesn't really work, in practice. So I think in practice, the caller, you know, has to be willing to support other people's children, as she does, as she says she is. She just seems a little miffed that parents are getting a sense of entitlement. Now, I can't say that I've noticed that. She perhaps has. I haven't noticed that. I don't notice any difference between people at my institute, which, you know, I'm a small employer. I have about 15 employees. I find that most people today feel entitled to take a day off whenever they want. In a white-collar, professional-type work setting, they don't think they have to ask to take vacation. They just announce when their vacation is. And I don't see that it's only parents who do that. Seems to me to be it's everybody.
Oh, that's interesting. So we better look at our work ethic, huh? There's a show for us.
Well, no, they work very hard. It's not that they don't work hard. It's just that, you know, they tend to think that these timing decisions don't have to be approved by anyone. You know, if you don't have a production line that demands that, you know, 1,000 cars be produced every week or whatever, it feels like you can have more autonomy as to when you take your vacation.
Right. Which is, well, that's
which is, you know, sort of true, but sometimes there are other considerations.
Right. Heidi, thanks so much. It was a very interesting hour. I appreciate your time. Thanks.
Well, I enjoyed it very much. Call us again sometime.
All right, we will.
Okay.
Heidi Hartman is president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington. It's an organization that she founded back in 1987 to meet the need for women-centered, policy-oriented research. She also teaches at George Washington University. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program and to John Treader for on-air production. Thank you for listening and calling. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.